KPLO FM program, Power to People.
That document cannot meaningfully be described without revealing classified information.
The Bush administration hid behind the state secret's privilege to spy on the American people. President Obama promised change, but recent court battles suggest the threats to our civil liberties will continue. Will the Obama administration continue to use the privilege of the presidency to hide unconstitutional actions from the public? We the People talked to Portland attorney Tom Nelson earlier this week to discuss how a local case of illegal spying could shed some light on the future of government surveillance on Americans. Join us this Thursday evening at 6, when We the People will take your calls to explore these questions and discuss your concerns. Listen and tell us what you think. We the People, last Thursday at 6 p.m., www.kboo.fm/we the people.
I'm Lena Alialoro.
This is Scott Fink.
This is Linda Olsen-Austin.
This is Owen Bastable.
I'm Cicely Rogers.
I'm Lisa Lewis.
I'm Brian Pritchett.
This is Rebecca Nay.
I'm Robert Barnford.
Volunteer-run, community-powered. This is the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, updates on the drug war in Mexico.
Oregon gets millions of stimulus dollars for energy efficiency projects.
President Obama holds an online town hall meeting.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 26, 2009. I'm Allison Milionis.
And I'm Sun Lee. Oregon will get $33 million from the federal government for energy efficiency and conservation projects. The White House and U.S. Energy Department made the announcement today. The money is part of the Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The State Energy Office will receive $9.5 million from the program. Other big winners will be Portland, Clackamas County, and Washington County. Tribal governments will also receive grants under the program. Grants to Oregon tribes range from $25,000 to $300,000.
To finalize plans for a Major League Soccer expansion team in Portland, City Council will have to act fast. The Portland Tribune reports today that the tight schedule may leave little or no time for debate on the details of bringing the franchise to Portland. City Council needs to figure out funding sources and decide on a location for a new AAA baseball park near the Rose Quarter. The new baseball stadium will be necessary once PGE Park is renovated for full-time soccer. The city's current plan is to come up with $15 million for the park renovations by using revenue from a future urban renewal area. But that plan faces opposition from school board members and the chairman of the Multnomah County Commission. There is also controversy about the site of the new baseball stadium and concern that rushing into a decision could complicate a master plan for the Rose Quarter area.
The Western Wood Products Association expects U.S. lumber demand to drop to a record low this year. The Portland-based association issued a forecast yesterday, placing demand for this year down 30% from 2008. They say demand is at its lowest level since the association began keeping records in 1955. A weak housing market is dragging down the lumber mill industry. The association says home construction traditionally accounts for more than 45% of lumber use. The group predicts demand will increase again in 2010.
Just as the unemployment rate hit 9.7% in the Salem area, Rain Sweet announced it will be closing its onion processing operation in West Salem by May 1st. No reason was given, and officials have not returned calls. About 118 workers will be affected, and there will be permanent layoffs. Rain Sweet employs about 250 people during the winter months, as well as seasonal help during the summer. Along with onions, Rain Sweet processes and sells frozen berries, peppers, mushrooms, and bell peppers to other food companies.
The Oregon Institute of Technology and Klamath Community College are offering free tuition to recently unemployed. The president of the two Klamath Falls schools announced this week that any Oregon resident who was laid off since October 1st can take classes for free during the spring term on a space-available basis. Spring term begins next week, but OIT is giving potential applicants until April 1st to notify the school of their interest. Qualified students have until April 13th to apply for the community college's courses.
TriMet announced budget and service cuts in February, and now it looks like things are getting worse. TriMet's budget is forecast to be even lower because rising unemployment is lowering payroll tax revenue. Over one half of TriMet's budget comes from payroll tax. In response to the revenue cut, TriMet is proposing possible staff layoffs and furloughs and the elimination of 5 bus lines. It also wants to modify or combine 7 more bus lines and lower the frequency of max light rail service. There will be hearings on the changes on April 6th, 7th, and 8th, and public comments will be accepted until April 10th.
Members of the new Healthcare Equality Project say the poor and members of minority groups receive unequal medical access and treatment. Groups represent non-white Oregonians are banding together to fight a persistent problem in the healthcare system. In collaboration with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Dane Gatewood has more.
Healthcare reform has been the talk of the Oregon legislature this session, and members of the state's racial and ethnic minority groups want to make sure they're included in any plan that's approved. They formed an Oregon coalition, part of a national campaign for healthcare equality. The group contends people are often treated differently in the healthcare system based on their income, and Joanne Bowman of Oregon Action says when there's also a racial difference, the white person gets better care.
You would get offered more tests, you would spend more time with the doctor, and it's just the way our healthcare system has been operating for way too long. Some assumptions are made about people of color that just aren't true.
The Healthcare Equality Project is made up of civil rights and women's groups, labor unions, and even some doctors and healthcare workers. Their view is that it's not enough to insure all people if the system doesn't allow all people access to quality healthcare. According to U.S. Census data, 1 in 4 Oregonians is non-white, and almost 500,000 speak a language other than English at home. The group says it's not always intentional, but language and cultural barriers are common and can be intimidating. Joseph Santos Lyons with the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon says it's surprising how many Oregonians don't realize how diverse the state has become, which is another reason for the new coalition.
We know that as Asians and Pacific Islanders, we can only achieve so much just on our own, and that we need to build strong relationships and allies amongst other communities, particularly other communities of color, to be able to do the joint policy work together.
For KBOO News, I'm Dane Gatewood.
Yesterday, the Oregon House voted to pass an anti-bullying law for Oregon schools. Under the Oregon Safe Schools Act, schools would have to create anti-bullying policies and investigate incidents of bullying. The bill defines bullying as actions that interfere with the psychological well-being of another child. Critics of the bill say that vague language like that could create problems and lawsuits if the bill becomes law. The bill passed a vote of 50-9 and will now move to a vote in the Oregon Senate.
Two natural allies, parents and teachers, are taking opposing stands on education reform this legislative session. At a packed Senate hearing in Olympia, Washington yesterday, parents and their children plan to speak out in favor of proposals to change the way the state pays for education. They say they've waited long enough. At the same hearing, teachers spoke out against the two pending measures that would also revise the definition of basic education. The teachers say lawmakers should find a way to pay for education reform before making changes the state can't afford. The Senate Education Committee chairwoman says lawmakers will work hard to find a compromise and pass a bill before the legislature adjourns.
An 8-year-old beluga whale at the Point Defiant Zoo and Aquarium in Tacoma is sick, and experts are trying to learn the cause. The general curator says the beluga whale began losing interest in food on March 15th. Veterinarians ran blood tests Monday and determined that the animal, one of the aquarium's top attractions, has an unknown infection. National experts are doing more tests. Meanwhile, workers at the zoo have been helping the whale swallow fish and salmon oil for extra nutrition. Veterinarians also are making changes in the whale's antibiotics and other medications and are trying to reduce stress on the whale.
The head of the Center for Constitutional Rights stated this week that the newly released Bush torture memos constitute an act of treason. for which the Bush administration should be charged in criminal court. At the same time, prominent Republicans and Democrats have called for criminal charges to be filed against the former president. KBOO's Jenkins Soderbergh spoke with David Swanson of AfterDowningStreet.org, who says the Obama administration is taking steps to avoid prosecution of George W. Bush.
You have written extensively about the imperial presidency and what you call a monarchy under Bush. And I wanted to ask about the changes that have taken place under the Obama administration. Are we going to see an end to the imperial presidency?
Probably not any day soon. There's no indication of it. Presidents since George Washington was president have begun to expand the power of the presidency, and very rarely has any power that one president established not remained to future presidents. So it's not that I think Obama has already been as abusive and destructive and had as negative policy impacts on the country and the world as Bush did, or that he's likely to, but that he is maintaining the same powers, abusing many of them and expanding some of them, and retracting very few. I mean, he began with a wonderful announcement that he will end torture, and that he would close at least one location where we detain people outside of the law, Guantanamo, although there are many others. But he treats these things as policy differences. So we now have different policies on torture and different policies on detention and rendition, things that he will claim the right to maintain, detaining people outside the law, rendering people to other nations. And these used to be called crimes. These didn't used to be things you had policies on. And President Obama doesn't want to call them crimes because then he would have to prosecute the criminals of his of the preceding administration. So he wants to call them policy differences. But the thing that does is it maintains the power to commit those crimes for himself and for future presidents, which is incredibly dangerous.
He has already invoked state secrets on two different occasions, as was finally reported in the Washington Post yesterday. What do you think that says about the administration?
Well, it says that they do not want a public discussion of warrantless spying or torture. They want to avoid it at all costs, and they want to avoid prosecuting those crimes. You'll recall that during the campaign, candidate and Senator Obama reversed his position against the overwhelming demand of his supporters and supported a bill in Congress that attempts to retroactively give immunity to corporations involved in the warrantless spying. Well, here you have a case to hold some people responsible and to reveal to the public some of what our supposedly democratic government has been doing, and they're pulling out all the stops to block it. And similarly with torture, President Obama does not want the public to know what has gone on. It would make it all the more difficult to do what he is absolutely bound, what his attorney general is bound by law and by treaties to do, and that is to prosecute the criminals. Now, the good side of this, the silver lining, is that for once we are seeing leading Congress members and senators stand up a little bit, at least on their knees, against this sort of abuse of power, regardless of party, so that we have leading Democrats in both houses reintroducing something called the State Secrets Protection Act, which would require that a court review in closed session such claims of state secrets.
I've been speaking with David Swanson. His website, davidswanson.org. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Jenka Soderbergh with KBOO News.
Two of the minds behind the invasion of Iraq have started a new neoconservative group. The new group is called Foreign Policy Initiative, or FPI. Two of the group founders previously started the project for the New American Century. That group played an essential role in drumming up support for the invasion of Iraq, both before and after September 11th. Critics fear that FPI will try to have a warlike influence on foreign policy. So far, the group has supported a military increase in Afghanistan. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz are all charter members of the new group.
Today in Iraq, at least 16 people have been killed and 35 others wounded by a car bomb at a crowded market in Baghdad. The car bomb attack came 3 days after a suicide attack against Kurdish mourners in central Iraq, which killed nearly 30 people. At least 4 children and 3 women were among the casualties in today's blast, next to a bus terminal in the mostly Shiite district of Shab. The explosion came a day after a U.S. military spokesman said attacks across the country had dropped to their lowest level since the months following the 2003 invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein.
In the human cost of occupation in Iraq, the U.S. Department of Defense has confirmed 4,259 deaths of U.S. soldiers in Iraq since 2003. There are 2 deaths awaiting confirmation. On the Iraqi side, multiple studies have estimated that over 1 million Iraqis have been killed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, although the exact number of civilians killed is unknown. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by We the People at 6. On tonight's show, we'll hear from Portland lawyer Tom Nelson on his lawsuit against the U.S. government for illegal wiretapping of his clients. Tomorrow's weather is a 20% chance of rain or drizzle, mostly cloudy with a high near 55.
The current time is 5:16 p.m., and now time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you live near a stream, should you be allowed to dump waste in it? I don't mean a garbage bag of waste, but tons of it. Toxic waste that buries the stream and contaminates downstream drinking water so badly that it runs black out of the tap. If such obscene selfishness would offend you, you're probably not an executive of a coal corporation. In Appalachia, coal barons routinely explode the tops off of ancient forest-covered mountains, then merrily bulldoze the resulting tons of coal waste and rubble down the sides into the valleys and streams below. All so they can get at the coal more cheaply and haul away a fatter profit. Mountaintop removal, they call it. A process that is an environmental rape and an ethical disgrace. Already, 500 of America's oldest, most beautiful mountains have been decapitated, and more than 1,200 miles of pristine streams have been buried. Isn't this a violation of our Clean Water Act? Of course! Except that a 2002 rule change by Bush and Company perverted the law, redefining water pollutants to exclude mining waste. Then, early this year, a Bush-appointed federal court ruled that stream burial is okay, giving the green light to 90 more mountain destruction projects. However, Alliance for Appalachia, a grassroots coalition of 13 regional groups, is pushing a congressional bill to outlaw this outrage, and it has a good chance to pass. H.R. 1310, the Clean Water Protection Act, already has 116 co-sponsors, and President Obama says he's against mining coal by, quote, simply blowing the tops off mountains. This is Jim Hightower saying Obama can make the difference, both by aggressively backing the bill and by directing the Corps of Engineers to suspend mining permits for mountaintop removal. To get more information and learn how you can help, go to ilovemountains.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publishers of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
President Obama held a first-ever online town hall meeting today, responding to a few of the of over 100,000 questions submitted. On Tuesday, Obama made public a section of the White House website called Open for Questions. President Obama.
This is an experiment, but it's also an exciting opportunity for me to look at a computer and get a snapshot of what Americans across the country care about. I'm looking forward to the results. We may not always agree on everything, but this way I can get a sense of your concerns and give you some straight answers. So, America, what do you want to know about the economy? Just go to whitehouse.gov and ask me.
People from across the country submitted questions on the economy and other topics, including education, health care, veteran affairs, the auto industry, and employment. Participants could then vote on the questions they wanted the president to answer, and he addressed the most popular questions. 3.5 million votes came in since Tuesday, and the two most popular questions were on the legalization of marijuana. Obama laughed off the idea, saying that he, quote, doesn't know what this says about the online audience, and answered the question simply saying that no, he doesn't believe that legalization of marijuana is a good strategy.
I don't know what this says about the online audience, but I just want, I don't want people to think that this was a fairly popular question. We want to make sure that it was answered. The answer is no, I don't think that is a good strategy to grow our economy. So, all right.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up.
Other top questions focused on how to channel more government funds into higher education, relieve student loans, and increase employment. Some have compared the online town hall to Franklin Roosevelt's fireside chats, broadcast by radio through the nation during the Great Depression of the 1930s.
The Pentagon is doing research on killer robots. The goal is for the robots to act on their own without human control. One expert predicts that faster action on the battlefield will mean robots will be needed to make life and death decisions. Other experts are concerned that robots would not be able to distinguish between military targets and innocent civilians in a war zone. The U.S. military is currently using armed drone aircraft to attack military targets in Iraq and Afghanistan, but a human on the ground makes the final decision to shoot. A 2007 Army request for proposals to design future robots essentially calls for the development of robotic killers. One artificial intelligence expert has said that the robots should be built unless the ethical issues can be resolved.
The House overwhelmingly approved a bill that lawmakers say will help control the escalating cost of fighting wildfires. The vote on Thursday was 412-3. The bill would establish a separate fund to cover the cost of combating major wildfires in the U.S. Lawmakers have long complained that the Forest Service and other federal agencies overspent on fighting the wildfires. Fighting wildfires takes up nearly half of the Forest Service budget, pushes out funding for other needed programs. The wildfire fund would not be a part of normal agency budgets and would only be used for emergencies such as catastrophic fires. The bill now goes to the Senate.
British Parliament member George Galloway has been denied entry into Canada after leading a convoy of 100 trucks of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip. The convoy consisted of medical aid, food, clothing, school supplies, building materials, a fire truck, two ambulances, and the trucks themselves. Irish activist John Herson was on the caravan.
Once we get through the border and into Gaza, I never felt as humbled in all my life, because here were the people that we had set out to help, and there they were to see us, you know. And to the day I die, I will never forget the look on their faces and in their eyes and them thanking us. And basically, you know, I just wish I had, you know, 10 times as much stuff with me. But because don't forget, they're sitting in a caged in Egypt on one side, Israel on the other, and they can't travel. They cannot get out through that door. You know, they're not allowed out through that border post, and they're basically, as I say, they're prisoners within a big prison cell, and their food is cut off from them. They have no access, and people do not get to see what the reality is in Gaza. And it's, you know, that's, I personally will make it my mission to tell as many people as I possibly could, and that's why I'm talking to you in Portland, my old town, and I know there's a lot of very, very good people there. And I'm appealing to people there to please, please, please phone whoever you can, your congressman or your senators, your government, whatever. And please, 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 I'm appealing to everybody that I possibly can to try and do whatever you can to lift the siege of Gaza. Because it's inhumane. And in the year 2009, that a government like America, is supporting a regime like Israel that is keeping them people trapped in that prison cell is so wrong, you have no idea. It's horrible. To treat another person, another human being in that regard is a very, very sorry sight.
That was Irish peace activist John Herson speaking on his trip to Gaza with the Viva Palestina humanitarian aid caravan. A full interview with Herson about the caravan can be heard this coming Monday morning on KBOO at 11 o'clock a.m.
British police have opened an investigation into the torture of a former Guantanamo prisoner. British citizen Binam Mohammed said he was tortured in custody in Pakistan and Morocco after being sent there in 2004 on a rendition flight. Mohammed claims that British intelligence agencies supplied the questions asked by his torturers at a secret black site in Morocco. His lawyers praised today's announcement, but said that the government must allow the police to have access to secret documents for the investigation to be complete. Mohammed was released from the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in February after spending 7 years in U.S. captivity without charge.
The opportunities for women improved globally in 2008, but a vast gender gap remains even in the most improved nations. This is according to the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Report for 2008. The report ranks countries according to gender equality in four areas: economic participation and opportunity, educational attainment, political empowerment, and health and survival. More than 90 of the 115 countries covered in the report showed an overall improvement. Though the world made progress on economic, political, and education gaps, the report also showed women face increased difficulty accessing health resources. The United States ranked 27th, up marginally from 2007. Norway led the rankings, and Yemen was last.
Human Rights Watch has called on the Malaysian government to repeal its suspension of two opposition newspapers. Malaysia's Home Ministry on Tuesday barred the opposition party and its coalition from publishing newspapers for 3 months. Human Rights Watch said the decision will harm the party's ability to garner voter support for elections taking place in April. The Malaysian Home Minister accused the newspapers of publishing false stories aimed at inciting hatred for the government and leaders. But Human Rights Watch described the ban as unfair political warfare. Newspapers in Malaysia are required to renew their publishing licenses every year under government legislation. The Home Minister has discretionary powers to grant, revoke, or suspend licenses.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues her visit to Mexico today on the heels of the new plans to beef up the U.S. law enforcement presence along the border with Mexico. Clinton announced plans to establish a new office in Mexico staffed by Mexican and U.S. officials. The office would monitor the implementation of the Mérida Initiative, often called Plan Mexico, due to its similarities with Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia is a multi-billion-dollar counter-narcotics strategy developed during the presidency of Secretary Clinton's husband. In a written statement released today, Mexican President Felipe Calderón expressed a desire to increase bilateral cooperation in the area of public security. Calderón has made public security and the fight against drug cartels a centerpiece of his policy since taking over the presidency in December of 2006. But that fight against the cartels has resulted in one of the bloodiest periods of modern Mexican history, with an estimated 6,000 drug-related deaths in 2008 alone. FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Luis Arriga from the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico City.
Luis, thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon.
What have been the overall effects of the government's war against the cartels on Mexico's civilian population?
The number of reports of human rights violations committed by soldiers has increased more than 600% since 2006, the year that Felipe Calderón took office, according to data from the Mexican National Human Rights Commission. So during the administration of Felipe Calderón, reported abuses included extrajudicial executions, rape, and other sexual abuse, the use of torture, warrantless invasion of homes, and numerary arbitrary detentions.
What about Fuero Militar, this law that shields the military from prosecution in civilian courts, even when civilians are the victims of military crimes?
Well, because of this violation, if investigated at all, they are investigated and tried by military authorities, and they remain unpunished. Since 2006, in only 6% of military investigations into abuses committed against civilians were any soldiers charged, and we do not know of any cases during this time of period in which soldiers were convicted and punished for acts that constitute human rights violation. And this is why we emphasize that human rights violation committed by the military must be investigated by independent civilian authorities and not military authorities.
But some would argue that the military presence in places like Ciudad Juarez is necessary due to pervasive corruption within the ranks of the local police.
Well, the military it's not training to investigate crimes and also to carry out policing work. That is a work for the police. I mean, it is not the main goal of the military forces. And instead of that, we are having a lot of human rights violations. We need to fix the police. I mean, public security, it's a civil matter. It is not a military matter.
What can be done from the U.S. side of the border to reduce drug-related crime in Mexico?
We think at CENTROPRO that the most efficient way from the United States to fight specifically the drug trafficking is through domestic measures to reduce demand for drugs and reduce the flow of arms to Mexico. Any foreign aid from the U.S. should not go to the military, but rather go to supporting judicial reform or strengthening civilian institutions or addressing issues such as the poverty.
That was Luis Arriaga, the director of the Miguel Agustin Pro Juarez Human Rights Center in Mexico City.
Earlier this week, the Obama administration announced efforts to step up the drug war in Mexico. John Gibler is a reporter currently traveling between Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, and the author of Mexico Unconquered, Chronicles of Power and Revolt. Gibler sees an administration's policy announcement as a continuation of a failing military-style plan and suggests the U.S. take a closer look at what's going on at the border.
Perhaps the first time a very high-level federal official in the United States is simply acknowledging some one or two aspects of the United States' own responsibility for the violence related to the drug war, especially the violence that plagues Mexico. And I was speaking to people in Juarez today and asking them, what do you think about Clinton's pronouncements? And one person, for example, a small businessman who owns a book distribution business in Ciudad Juarez, told me, well, you know, it sounds great. It's the words you say on a diplomatic visit and it's very good protocol. But, you know, so many times federal officials from the United States show up to Mexico, say all sorts of pretty things, but then no real change happens. And that's what people are really waiting for. And also the focus there of what Obama has mentioned so far is really, even though it's expressed more eloquently, but it still it seems like a continuation of the same failed drug war policies, and that is just seeing everything from a security perspective or a military perspective, even sort of sending more money, more police officers to the border, only thinking in terms about a military police response to what is also deeply a social and economic phenomenon. And again, the taboo, of course, is talk about legalization or to talk about any kind of regulation of banned substances, which would be perhaps at this stage really the only policy initiative that could seriously affect the levels of violence and diminish, bring down the levels of violence related to the international drug trade.
The United States government always liked to export the perception of chaos to other countries. So the drug war is always the ground zeroes in the drug war are always far abroad. They're always in Colombia, and there's, you know, the media reports that come out showing Colombia is this lawless, you know, death zone. And then something similar is now happening with Mexico, where you have all of these major media reports kind of parachuting in and talking about what is definitely very real and very horrible levels of violence. But this kind of attempt to export this perception of violence and of chaos, whereas, you know, where is the similar headline or report about the levels of drug-related homicides in the United States?
That was John Gibler, author of Mexico Uncovered.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories of Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, March 26, 2009. Fighters clash with Israeli troops in Gaza and soldiers kidnap civilians in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Fighters from Saraya al-Quds Brigade, the arm wing of the Islamic Jihad group in Gaza, clashed with Israeli soldiers near the border fence with Israel in the southern Gaza Strip. The Saraya al-Quds Brigade claimed that their fighters clashed with an undercover Israeli military unit patrolling the border area in the southern eastern part of Gaza Strip town of Khan Yunis on Thursday midday. Elsewhere, Palestinian sources in the northern West Bank city of Nablus reported on Thursday morning that Israeli soldiers invaded Askar and Balata refugee camps east of Nablus, broke into several homes, and kidnapped seven youth. In other news, an Israeli court in Jerusalem issued an eviction decision against the As-Silwadi family, ordering them to leave their home and the dunam of land around it after defense lawyer failed to present documents for their case. Israel has intensified its campaign of demolishing Palestinian-owned homes. The Jerusalem municipality handed out demolition orders to 96 Palestinian families in the first week of March. Another 88 orders were handed out in February. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem, an act which violates international law. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Rassam Banoura and George Ishmawi.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we're open to your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is David Nockinson and Maggie Starr. Our engineer is Judy Fiestel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM, on transmitter K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. I'm Allison Milionis.
And I'm Sun Lee. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, host Arnie Haynes speaks with Julie Dorf, advisor at the Council for Global Equality, about international gay, lesbian, and trans human rights. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices. Host Will Seaman and guest Wael El-Asadi speak with Jabir Wissa, Deputy Director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza. Ayana Tin-Pollock of Anarchists Against the Wall about political prisoners in Israel and Israeli war crimes in Gaza. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Digital Divide presents the latest in science and technology affecting our planet with a focus on the recent South by Southwest Interactive Conference. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 26th of March, 2009. From Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Bobado. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner unveils a proposal to regulate the financial industry.
To address this will require comprehensive reform. Not modest repairs at the margin, but new rules of the game. And the new rules must be simpler and more effectively enforced.
And we'll go to Indian-administered Kashmir, where fighting between Indian troops and Muslim guerrillas has claimed more than 24 lives. All that and more after these headlines.
I'm Renee Phelps with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Britain, police announced they will investigate claims that the British Secret Service was complicit in the interrogation, rendition, and torture of a Guantanamo Bay detainee. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Binyam Mohammed was recently returned to the UK without charge after 7 years in captivity. The British government has always carefully denied his allegations. No one knows how long this police inquiry will take or where it may end. But an MI5 officer has already anonymously given evidence in the High Court. He said that at the time he considered his involvement lawful and approved at the highest level. Mr. Mohammed says during interrogations he was shown surveillance footage, photos and other intelligence from the UK. In an interview with the BBC, he described one of the contacts he had with an MI5 officer at that time.
Right from the start they came in and I was threatened with rendition. I lost any kind of hope of asking for any kind of help because right from the start I was told where I was going to go, I was going to be tortured.
Lawyers representing Mr. Mohammed say they're worried crucial evidence will be withheld from the police. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Arbitrary detention is widespread in Afghanistan and violates Afghans' constitutional rights. This, according to a new report from the United Nations. Chief Human Rights Officer of the UN mission in Afghanistan, Nora Nyland.
There's a practice and a history in Afghanistan that people are quite often seen to be guilty before proven innocent, that rather than the other way around. In judicial systems, people are innocent until they are proven guilty. So there's an attitude issue, which is really a history of how practices have been done in the past.
The UN report monitored 2,000 Afghan detentions since 2006. It recommends authorities strengthen oversight and accountability. In related news, Afghan authorities arrested a television presenter on Monday for offending Muslim clerics. Watchdog group Reporters Without Borders says journalists face intensifying pressure in the lead-up to presidential elections. We'll have more on Afghanistan later in the program. In Argentina, farmers are continuing their nationwide strike in a battle over trade limits and export tariffs. FSRN's Marie Trigonia reports from Buenos Aires.
On the fifth day of the strike, farmers have set up roadblocks along major highways, prohibiting trucks carrying grain and livestock to cross checkpoints. Supermarkets and suppliers in Argentina's capital report shortages of vegetables, meat, and rice. This is a seventh strike in the past year against the government's decision to raise the export tax on soybeans to 35%. Economist Alan Sibbles says that with a slump in economic growth, the government cannot afford to lower the tax.
A substantial part of government revenues comes from export taxes, between 25% and a third. Because the prices drop, that has an impact on government revenues.
Farmers have been hit hard by the international financial crisis, which caused food commodity values to plummet. On top of that, a severe drought has cut soy production by half. Argentina is one of the world's leading soybean producers, and the renewed farmer strike has driven international soy prices to a five-week high. Marie Trigona, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
In the southern United States, plans to spray toxic herbicide along the U.S.-Mexico border have been suspended. U.S. Border Patrol officials want to use helicopters to douse vegetation on a one-mile stretch of the Rio Grande River near Laredo, Texas. They say defoliation would destroy plant life and make it easier to spot people hiding under trees. But Mexican officials oppose the plan, saying it could threaten human health and taint Nuevo Laredo's water supply. If the U.S. decides to move forward, the aerial spraying could expand to include more than 130 miles along the border. And in Maryland, lawmakers have approved a bill that will place restrictions on when the death penalty can be pursued by prosecutors. The bill will require prosecutors to have DNA or biological evidence from the defendant before they can seek a death sentence. It will also require a videotaped confession and video of the defendant at the crime scene. Among those who rallied lawmakers to support the measure was Democratic delegate Craig Rice, whose aunt and cousin were murdered.
I must tell you that I placed my green vote today because I feel as though, as a proponent and a supporter of the death penalty, that we need to lay to rest the concerns and fears that we are putting people to death that are innocent. No victim's family wants to hear that an innocent person has been put to death as a result of the death penalty. I think that this bill is in very good posture in terms of laying to rest the concerns that are out there.
Maryland's Governor Martin O'Malley is expected to sign the reform bill. He narrowly lost a fight in January to repeal the death penalty. From the Community News Production Institute in New York City, I'm Renee Feltz.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has unveiled a broad proposal to bring the financial firms that escape government oversight into a new regulatory framework. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, Geithner is calling for a comprehensive plan to revamp the government's ability to regulate runaway firms.
Secretary Geithner returned to Capitol Hill for the second time in 1 week, this time under better circumstances. Not to be grilled over excessive executive compensation, but to promote a multi-layered plan of government regulation to rein in Wall Street.
To address this will require comprehensive reform. Not modest repairs at the margin, but new rules of the game. And the new rules must be simpler and more effectively enforced.
Geithner says lax regulation was a cause of the financial crisis.
U.S. law left regulators without good options for managing the failure of systemically important, large, complex financial institutions.
Currently, only traditional banking practices are regulated. Geithner's new proposal would bring entities and transactions such as hedge funds and the dubious credit default swaps under government purview. It would strengthen regulation of money markets, and it would create an oversight body that would monitor financial transactions and determine risk. Chair of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, offers a reminder of financial failure.
The two glaring examples are Lehman Brothers, where nothing was done, and AIG, where everything was done.
The new rules would be a major marker in the bumpy road of financial regulation. The stock market crash of 1929 resulted in a series of legislative actions to regulate the banks, the market, and major trusts. A path of deregulation began in the 80s and culminated with massive deregulation of banks in 1999. Many experts say this spurred innovation and creative ways to make easy money, including naked short selling and credit default swaps, which resulted in a financial environment out of control. If Geithner's plan passes, this would be the most robust set of regulatory law since the 1930s. And most of the proposals do need to pass Congress. Spencer Backus, top Republican on the Financial Services Committee, expressed concern.
This empowers federal regulators with incredible discretion. And some of the past experience that I have witnessed indicates that this discretion is not always administered fairly or even-handedly.
Many holes exist in the plan which Geithner expects Congress to help close, like which agencies will gain more oversight and who should lead the new oversight body. Geithner also says this is just the first step. He will release plans to protect consumers, streamline regulatory agencies, and coordinate a regulatory framework with international economies. President Obama will discuss a global framework at the G20 meeting next week. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
President Obama's nominee for ambassador to Afghanistan, Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee today. Members of the committee grilled Eikenberry on what success in Afghanistan would actually look like. Karen Miller has more.
Lawmakers had overwhelming praise for Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry, who was most recently the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. But some wanted clear answers about his ideas for a successful Afghanistan strategy. Here's Eikenberry responding to that question from Senator Kerry.
Success is in Afghanistan, inside of Pakistan, that we have defeated al-Qaeda and international terrorism, which threatens our country, and then in order to achieve that, creating the conditions in Afghanistan so that we don't have the environment which pervaded in the 1990s, which allowed al-Qaeda and international terrorism to have open sanctuary, to have an open safe haven inside of Afghanistan.
But al-Qaeda is fundamentally not in Afghanistan today.
Their presence inside of Pakistan, of course, fuels the insurgency and fuels attacks of terror inside of Afghanistan.
But the mission, of Afghanistan with respect to al-Qaeda is to keep them from coming back. Correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, they've been driven out. They're not there.
Eikenberry then provided even more clarification about what he deemed success.
This is about enabling the Afghans to develop governments and rule of law, enabling the Afghans to develop their own security forces, enabling the Afghans to develop a sustainable economy. Those are the three critical components. When they come together, success would be defined then as an Afghan state strong enough to not become an open safe haven for international terrorism.
Senator John Kerry responded that everything needs to be done with caution.
This is a very delicate balance, and I think in the process we want to be careful of how much we raise the stakes ourselves, on ourselves. The mission is to keep al-Qaeda from coming back. It may take the Afghans a little longer to develop their government, but they haven't proven in the last 6 years a particular disposition to want to do that, frankly.
But Eikenberry has also supported counterinsurgency tactics of General David Petraeus in Iraq. Friday, the Obama administration is expected to lay out its strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Eikenberry's nomination is expected to be voted on next week. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
Lawyers for an Oregon charity have accused the White House of maintaining the Bush administration's status quo with regards to secrecy. FSRN's Jenka Soderberg has more from Portland.
In the case of an Islamic charity, the Obama administration has called for a civil court to give back government documents that had previously been released to the court. The move has led some groups to claim that Obama is not living up to his promise to open up public disclosure rules and is instead continuing the Bush administration policy of secrecy. David Swanson is a political analyst and co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org.
You'll recall that during the campaign, candidate and Senator Obama reversed his position against the overwhelming demand of his supporters and supported a bill in Congress that attempts to retroactively give immunity to corporations involved in the warrantless spying. Well, here you have a case to hold some people responsible and to reveal to the public some of what our supposedly democratic government has been doing, and they're pulling out all the stops to block it.
In February, Attorney General Eric Holder invoked the state secrets privilege to avoid divulging information in a case against a Boeing subsidiary, which transported detainees in so-called extraordinary rendition flights. This new case involves the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation, an organization based in Saudi Arabia whose U.S. office is in Ashland, Oregon. The Justice Department charged the group in 2004 with being a front for the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. The DOJ later dropped all charges, but the foundation remains on the government's terrorist watch list and is banned in the U.S. The lawyers for Al Haramain said documents the Bush administration turned over showed illegal wiretapping by the National Security Agency. They then filed a case against the U.S. government to challenge warrantless wiretapping by the Bush administration. Unlike most of the cases brought against Bush, this one was granted standing by the courts and was allowed to move forward. Tom Nelson is a lawyer for the Al Haramain Foundation. He filed the lawsuit against the federal government for the wiretapping of his attorney-client conversations.
The result of the government's activities in wiretapping mean that no attorney can safely trust the internet, emails, telephone calls anymore. And if there is a matter involving national security or otherwise, we are all of us attorneys are put on notice that our communications of a privileged, confidential, and secret nature with our clients are being monitored. As a result of that, whenever I want to talk to my clients and obtain evidence or material from Saudi Arabia, I have to go there in person. When I engage in the communication, I take my cell phone out, leave it in the other room, and we go to a public area, preferably a street, to talk.
Legislation has been introduced in both the House and Senate that would curb the use of the State Secrets Act by the executive branch. The new law would allow judges to review evidence withheld under the state secrets privilege to see if it should be admissible in court. Analyst David Swanson says this legislation is significant because it crosses party lines.
For Democrats to be doing it in response to an abuse of power by a Democratic president, albeit an abuse that the preceding Republican engaged in frequently, is tremendous.
The bill, known as the State Secrets Protection Act, is currently in committee. Jenka Soderberg, FSRN, Portland.
Twenty-five people have died in a six-day-long gunfight between Indian troops and Muslim guerrillas in a forested area of Indian-administered Kashmir. While the fighting has stopped, the army said it was still scanning the area. Shanawat Khan has more.
The gunfight started on Friday, March 20, in Shamsabari and Hafruda forests of northern Kashmir's Kupwara district. The area is close to the line of control, the de facto border dividing Kashmir between India and Pakistan. The Indian Army says there were at least three battles with Muslim militants. Eight Indian Army soldiers were killed and 17 militants, according to government sources. Indian Army officer Brigadier Gurmeet Singh told reporters in Srinagar that the guerrillas had recently infiltrated the region.
The area of the encounter has thick jungle in difficult mountainous terrain. Terrorists were primarily an infiltration group which was attempting to infiltrate and a reception party which was waiting for their arrival. Mostly comprising of foreign terrorists, essentially belonging to Lashkar-e-Taiba Tanzim.
The Lashkar-e-Taiba, a major guerrilla group active in Kashmir, claimed responsibility for the encounter. A spokesperson for the group told Srinagar-based journalists they killed 25 Indian troops in the gunfight. Independent verification of the contesting claims was not possible. Wasim Khalid, a Srinagar-based journalist, says there are reasons to doubt both versions.
Sometimes we have to doubt army version. You see, 2 months ago in the ending week of January, there was an encounter in Poonch. And the army claimed that they killed four militants during the encounter. But when after the encounter was over, nobody was found or neither anybody was identified.
Lashkar-e-Taiba vowed to continue attacks on Indian troops in Kashmir. The group has been banned by Pakistan's government after being accused of involvement in the Mumbai terrorist attack. It denies its involvement in the terror attack. Brigadier Singh accused Pakistani agencies of aiding the militants.
The maps and the guidance communication equipment with them is indicative that the state and the security forces assistance from across was there, as such material is not usually in the civil domain.
Both India and Pakistan claim Kashmir in full. An anti-India Muslim insurgency broke out in Indian administered Kashmir in 1989, where anti-India sentiment runs deep. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
And that wraps it up for today's broadcast. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Kump and Vinod K. Joes. Renee Feltz was today's headlines editor. Leanne Caldwell is the Washington editor. Our technical team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katapchi. Visit us online at fsrn.org or send us an email at comments@fsrn.org. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young, sitting in for Aura Bogado.
The time is 6 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is We the People. Welcome to another edition of We the People. Tonight, the state secrets privilege. I'm your host, Alejandro Caral.
And I'm Linda Olsen-Osterland.
We have a great show tonight. We've interviewed Tom Nelson, an attorney representing an Oregon charity that's been under surveillance by the current administration and the past administration. So we'll discuss the Bush administration's hiding behind the state secrets privilege and the current administration apparently following the same path. So we invite you to please call us at 503-231-8187 and tell us what you think about the Obama administration's current position on state secrets. You can also email us at wtpkboo@gmail.com or send us your comments online at kboo.fm, the website for our radio station, kboo.fm.
So let's get the show started. Pat Kilpatrick wanted to know who's got a secret. We have a special piece from Pat right now. Well, he's coming up pretty soon, so just a second, and we'll get the answer to Pat's question of who's got a secret.
Even though we all give lip service to the right to privacy, it seems like a common occurrence, in my experience, that one partner in a relationship will feel justified in reading the other's email under certain circumstances. The argument goes like this. My boyfriend has been acting strange, and one day he left his email logged in. So, I took a look to see if he's been talking with someone else. Sure enough, he was that jerk. Therefore, the investigation was justified on the grounds that he was a liar all along. And besides, if I'm being lied to or cheated upon, don't I have the right to do everything in my power to protect myself? If I catch aforementioned lying jerk, doesn't that prove that he didn't have the right to keep such secrets anyway? There are terrorists in Ashland, Oregon. Or there were, anyway. Or maybe better, there was an office of an Islamic charity named Al-Haramain. In 2004, the government decided that this was a terrorist organization with links to Al-Qaeda, and they should freeze its assets. So they did. And in case you're wondering how to freeze an asset, well, you need lawyers. But we could put it in terms of a domestic proceeding. It's sort of like, Wallace, son, I'm afraid I'm going to have to freeze your ability to use the car indefinitely on suspicion that you're a beer-drinking illegal teenager. Now, the funny thing about Al-Haramain versus Bush is that when the lawyers presented the evidence to Al-Haramain, they accidentally provided them with a document that showed that the government had been illegally spying on them. Oops. This would be sort of equivalent to the mom inadvertently mentioning to the son that dad happened to be snooping through his room when he read the son's private journal, which describes at length his illegal beer drinking activities. The son, incensed at this breach of confidence, confronts his father with the charge of improper snooping and demands a hearing to levy the charge of illegal parenting, including the restoration of full car use privileges.
In the fall of 2004, the government inadvertently disclosed to the plaintiff a classified document. That document, to this day, remains totally classified. It's classified at the top secret level at SCI. It's subject to handling constraints that extend beyond those that would normally be applicable even to top secret information. Public record shows and explains that declassification is not warranted, notwithstanding the inadvertent disclosure. The public record also shows that that document cannot meaningfully be described without revealing classified information.
Now, the father knows that he cannot admit to the charge of improper snooping, as this would destroy his credibility in future domestic cases. Young Wallace says to his mom, "You admitted that Dad was reading my private journal, proof of illegal fatherhood." Mom, of course, realizing that she has compromised Dad's journal tapping program, is tight-lipped on the matter, neither confirming nor denying her earlier assertion. Dad says, "See, son, there's no proof."
Everyone agrees that in order to establish their standing and a prima facie case, plaintiffs would have to establish that they were surveilled. They say they can show they were surveilled. And there's one and only one thing they point to for that suggestion, and that is their mental recollection, their memory of what remains in their minds of the document. But as I was saying, Your Honors, once the document is out of the case, which it has to be because it's privileged, it seems to us quite clear that mental recollections of the document are also out of the case. The only way to test the veracity of those recollections would be to compare them against the document itself.
The clips you've heard are from the August 17, 2007 hearing. Thomas Bondi is representing George W. Bush. On November 16, 2007, the court determined that the case against the government could go on, but that the defendant, George Bush, had won its state secrets privilege claim that the document could not be admitted as evidence in the case. A win-lose situation for both sides. On July 2, 2008, Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker ruled on the lawsuit. Finally, a solid conclusion, and it was. Al-Haramain's lawsuit is dismissed on the grounds of no evidence because the document was inadmissible. No car privileges for young Wallace. But he also ruled that the Bush administration had overstepped its bounds in sidestepping the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. That is, the government is still supposed to get a warrant to listen to citizens' phone conversations. And in fact, young Wallace can file an amended case to the domestic court once again if he can prove that he is an aggrieved teenager, that the reading of the journal that totally happened but is not allowed to be proven that it happened has screwed up his life enough, then he can bring the case back. And if young Wallace can prove this point, mom might be forced to speak up and tell the truth, but only if Wallace is really aggrieved. And this is where we're going to have to let the lawyers take over. Mom and dad are no longer competent to adjudicate this case.
We just heard an interesting piece by Patrick Kilpatrick, contributor to We the People. I want to remind listeners to please call in 503-231-8187. We have another edition, another call-in edition of We the People. You can also send us your comments and thoughts at wtpkboo@gmail.com. Linda, one of the things that Patrick was analogizing, this analogy that he used about the parental figure and the son doing something illegal, but then the father surveilling illegally. The father effectively hides behind the parental secrets privilege. The mom sort of taking, you know, him taking refuge behind the mom. Explain to us, though, what is the state secrets privilege, and if you could, in broad terms.
Well, the state secrets privilege is really something that was established in court beginning in 1929, and in the interview with Tom Nelson later, he talks a little bit about that original case. But it's a privilege like the privilege given to priest and penitent, to doctor and patient, and it's established in legal precedent. And what its intention was to do is to protect the national security of our nation in cases where civil litigation might reveal something that could cause irreparable harm to our national security. So the idea was that the president, and only the president, can put forward the state secrets privilege through his Justice Department, claiming that some aspect of a case that's before a court would in some way violate national security or cause irreparable harm. Unfortunately, in the history of the use of this, the overwhelming majority of the cases, the justices just say, oh, you say there's a national security issue, oops, everything stops. But there have also been cases and precedent for doing on-camera looks at it in private chambers, looks at it, people who are vetted and classified being able to look at documents or at different forms of evidence so that national security can be preserved, but cases can move forward. That's it in a nutshell.
But it's up to the government to define what is national security. In other words, you know, what national security is completely up to the executive branch. Is that true?
Well, the claim is up to the branch, but it's up to the judiciary to say whether that claim is legitimate. They have to put forward evidence for their assertion. Or they can be required to put forward evidence for their assertion. Not all justices do ask them to.
But we're still talking about a closed loop, though, between the president and his own Justice Department and his own appointed federal
comes before a court. And then you have the separation of powers where the court is not within the, you know, the executive doesn't get to order the court.
But they're stopping it from going into the court, correct? I mean, that's the situation that
that's
we're
what
with.
They attempt to do, but they can't do it. They do it through court. It's in a court process. There's a litigant saying this, and they want to present evidence, and then in that court case, the federal government comes in and asserts it. So it's already within the purview of the justice, of the judicial system, not the Justice Department.
So in a sense, to kind of summarize a little bit, but in a sense, what the state secret privilege does is it gives the executive the power to control the evidence that could challenge that assertion. Isn't that part of the problem?
Well, it's a pretty big tool in their hands. It may be an important tool, but may be wrongly used.
So it may be that the tool is too blunt or too broad, and maybe we need something a little bit narrower that addresses some of the concerns that the plaintiffs have, that they basically have no recourse.
Well, let's explore that as we go ahead. I think that's some of what we're going to hear different opinions on from Tom Nelson himself in this case, and then hopefully some of our audience will call in and give us some conversation about that as well.
That's right. So we're going to go to the Tom Nelson interview in a few minutes. I want to remind our audience to call in at 503-231-8187. But to set up the interview, I also want to ask Joanne. She's been looking into a piece of legislation that was introduced in the last Congress. It's been reintroduced again. Tell us a little bit about this, and how does this tie in with the topic at hand?
Right. Senator Patrick Leahy and Senators Arlen Specter as well, have introduced the State Secret Protection Act. And what that would do would be certainly not to override state secrets altogether, but would add more of the checks and balances that we've come to expect, where judges could look over the information, whereas now they can simply rely on what the president, what the White House, and what the judiciary says. Well, you can't look at this. Trust us. You know, trust us. We're the government. You're not supposed to be checking this out. So what it's going to do is actually allow and set up a protocol for judges to actually review this outside of the federal government and make its own decisions, whether or not it really is a matter of national security.
And ultimately, it would give an opportunity for those plaintiffs to have recourse, even if they don't have the evidence that would basically prove their case.
Absolutely. It would restore, their opportunity. Whereas now it's just shut down based on the word of the government, and it doesn't go any further. But this would actually allow recourse through the judges having the opportunity to review this information and make its own decisions.
It's reasserting the separation of powers, the right of Congress, the right of the judiciary,
after the Bush administration so usurped those powers within themselves under the executive and claiming authority over them that I think this is the Congress trying to say, no, wait, we
right,
have a role.
Right. Reel it back in, actually. Yes.
Yeah.
And do we have a sense of what the Obama administration's position is on this? I have not heard anything.
I have not found out what the... realize what the position of the Obama administration is, but, you know, one of the questions and one of the things that so many advocates and people looking at this case are concerned about are the steps that have been taken up to this point and what indicators these are to us on where Obama stands on these issues. I mean, how much, you know, this is a very powerful tool in the hands of the White House and the presidency, and where is the incentive, the push, and to make him relinquish those powers? And right now we're not seeing a whole lot of that.
Great. Well, thank you for that. So, Linda, earlier this week you interviewed Tom Nelson. I think the interview is almost ready, but why don't you tell us a little bit about
it? Yeah, Tom Nelson is a local attorney who's also a human rights activist, and he has been working on the Al Haramain case. Like you said, it's a global charity that had a local angle. It had a local office down in Southern Oregon, and he's going to bring us up to date on what's been happening with this case. It's been the focus of a lot of intense attention in the last week because of some of the latest moves from the Obama administration.
Very good. I think the interview is ready. 503-231-8187. Please call in and join us.
This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for KBOO Radio, and my guest today is Tom Nelson, Oregon civil rights attorney and human rights activist. He's an attorney in one of the most important cases moving forward against the federal government. It's the case of Al Haramain versus the Treasury Department, and it's recently won an important victory in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's the first lawsuit to limit the Department of Justice use of the presidential state secret privilege in recent times. Welcome to KBOO, Tom.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, Al Haramain is based in Saudi Arabia with a global network of charity offices, including one here in Southern Oregon. And in the aftermath of 9/11, the federal government branded Al Haramain a terrorist organization and seized its funds. After years and years of investigation, the feds were unable to prove any of its allegations and have brought no charges against the charity. So Al Haramain is suing to remove the terrorist designation and to have their funds returned. And it's in this lawsuit that the current challenge to the government use of the state secrets privilege is occurring. So the challenge stems from some classified documents that were accidentally sent to the Oregon chapter of Al Haramain. The two attorneys who were representing the charity at that time found out that their attorney-client discussions were being listened into, and they want now to be assured that that will no longer happen. So this is sort of the backdrop for the victory you won under Judge Walker recently on February 27th, I believe. So can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the issue that was in front of Judge Walker that actually went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals was whether the state secrets privilege would prevent us from presenting any evidence whatsoever. And the Ninth Circuit said that, the state secret privilege appears to apply, but we are going to remand the matter to Judge Walker to see if the plaintiffs, the two attorneys, can show that Al Haramain was illegally wiretapped without using that secret document. And so we went back to Judge Walker, and Judge Walker looked at the information we provided, which is now part of the public record, also looked at the statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and determined that the provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act override or trump the state secrets privilege because there are specific procedures in the FISA statute. Judge Walker says you can proceed. You've shown me enough to indicate that you knew or that you can prove that you were being surveilled not, without using the secret document, and therefore we're at that stage. What happened then was really interesting. The judge put out his order and also required the two of our attorneys, one who's here in Portland, Steve Goldberg, be given top secret security clearances, or at least be vetted for top secret security clearances. They went through that process. They obtained an indication from the investigators that they were of sufficient character, etc., to obtain that. And then in a really surprising filing, the Department of Justice said, number one, we are not going to proceed further with this. We're not going to allow them to have that top secret clearance because they don't need to know the information in the file, point one. And number two, if Your Honor continues with this approach, we will come and reclaim or take or withdraw, I think was the word they used, withdraw the document from the court files. That really set off a firestorm because you have one of the other attorneys said, well, how are they going to withdraw it? With the Army, with the National Guard, with the FBI? It was an obvious threat by the Obama administration to tear apart the separation of powers doctrine, which gives the judiciary the power to determine what happens within its judicial control. And the document, the top secret document, is now lodged with Judge Walker. So it's really shaping up into a major constitutional issue. Since that happened, the government requested an opportunity to speak to or to file material with Judge Walker in secret, in other words, ex parte, it's called, without telling us what they were filing or what they were talking about. And there's been a silence since that February ruling, and we think that the Department of Justice and the Obama administration are speaking privately with Judge Walker about the issues in the case.
Boy, you brought up a couple really interesting and important points. One of the things that I think is particularly interesting is that Judge Walker came up with such a novel idea to have the two attorneys first given security clearances. I bet that caught the government by surprise as a method. Isn't there a role for national security, and isn't there a role for the presidential state secrets privilege?
Well, there's no question that national security interests must be respected, and we have gone out of our way from day one to say that we are not going to do anything that will jeopardize national security. Frankly, I've seen the document, a number of other people have seen the document, and nobody that I know of within the group that I know of that has seen the document has talked about its contents other than what's been publicly released by the government and in the initial complaint. The idea of attorneys being given top secret clearance isn't that unusual in similar cases.
Okay.
It's been done before. As a matter of fact, you may know the name Jonathan Turley, who's a lawyer who's a law professor out of George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He has top secret clearance, or he had top secret clearance for some other matters that he was handling relating to similar types of issues. So it happens. But here the government is in Judge Walker's case, is really taking a hard line. You know, they're doubling down on Bush. They're making Bush look bashful.
Which is a little bit surprising, and I know that Eric Holder has said that he's calling for a review of all of the cases where the presidential state secrets privilege has been invoked. However, I have noticed that in the Obama reviews, it doesn't necessarily mean there's any change. They review and then things stay the same. I could cite Guantanamo as one example. So I'm concerned that Eric Holder's review will not result in a change. And the reason I think people are calling for a change is that the state secrets privilege has been used in a blanket manner to stop all activities in many legitimate lawsuits against the government. So that's the issue here, is can the government use the state secrets privilege as a general kind of blanket to stop lawsuits that might reveal illegal government activity?
Well, first, you're right that Eric Holder has been a disappointment in his handling of this issue. The state secrets privilege will not be raised unless it comes from the executive. The privilege itself has a dark history. In the first case that started the state secrets privilege, a case called Reynolds, I think, that came out of the 1950s, the United States was sued because there was an allegation that an aircraft was defective. And the government responded, we can't tell you why the aircraft was defective. This is a state secret. We can't tell you why, in that case, a person was killed. State secrets is just too critical not for us to tell you. Those files were opened up about 40 years later, and it turned out that the allegation of a state secret was a lie. That the government, there was no state secret involved. It was a simple mechanical error, but the government used it to defeat a civil lawsuit hiding behind the national security banner. That is the concern here, that when people start talking about national security, they scare everybody to the point that we lose all control over our judicial and administrative functions.
When I was in court here in Portland, when Judge Walker was first hearing your challenge to the government about this, one of the things that I thought I saw in Judge Walker was a real distaste for the idea that that attorneys and clients before him in the court would need to be concerned that they were being spied on. And that was something he found offensive. It's clearly unconstitutional, but I think he also found it offensive. How important are the individual judges in making these kinds of decisions and rulings?
Well, the individual judges are very, very important. There's a school of jurisprudence called legal realism, and that addresses that issue, that judges really are only human beings, and they bring to their judicial role all of their experiences, background, attitudes, biases, and prejudices, and we all have them. But and other judges, like, say, in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the judges there have an absolutely different approach. If one whispers the word state secrets, everything freezes. You're right. Out here, fortunately, in Oregon, California, and among the Ninth Circuit generally, the attitude is that individual rights still mean something, and that eavesdropping on attorney privilege, attorney-client communications, doing that should raise a high barrier to the government's proceeding further. The result of the government's activities and wiretapping, things of that sort, mean that no attorney, frankly, no attorney can safely trust the internet, emails, telephone calls anymore. And if there is a matter involving national security or otherwise, all of us attorneys are put on notice that our communications of a privileged, confidential, and secret nature with our clients are being monitored. As a result of that, whenever I want to talk to my clients and obtain evidence or material from Saudi Arabia or elsewhere in the Middle East, I have to go there in person. When I engage in the communication, I take my cell phone out, leave it in the other room, and we go to a public area, preferably a street, to talk. So it really becomes a cloak and dagger thing. When
they make you almost behave like a criminal to be carrying out your legal activities as an attorney.
I think ethically I'm required to do it. If I didn't do that, if I had a reasonable suspicion that the government's listening to everything I say, and I think they are, I have to. I don't mind, you know, letting them listen to the music I listen to or eavesdrop on conversations even with my wife. But on the other hand, when I talk about legal matters that as a matter of legal ethics I must protect, there's no easy way around it, I have to take steps to frustrate what I think the government thinks is in the national interest it hears. So we have a real clash set up there because of the legal ethics of the legal profession.
Welcome back. You are listening to We the People, and that was part one of an interview with Tom Nelson by Linda Olsen Osterlund. Linda, one of the things that really strikes me about your interview is sort of the inability of the attorneys to move forward unless they got the judge on their side. In other words, the judge really controls a lot of the pace and everything of the case. But, you know, the what the attorneys can do is both in the hands of the judge and on the hands of the executive. So where is the balance here?
And if you have a timid judiciary, you're really in trouble. There were, I believe, over 40 lawsuits that were held all together, and I think it was the Ninth Circuit that did it, against telecom companies for going along with the National Security Agency in warrantless wiretapping of communications about email, etc. And those were legitimate lawsuits that were held for, they just got stopped and they sat there and they waited for over a year, most of them, because the justices said no, because the Justice Department had asserted the state secrets privilege. Those lawsuits in the end got dismissed because it took long enough that the legislature was able to pass a law that they thought sort of retroactively made legal what those telecom companies had been doing. That's a whole other story, but the point was those never got to see the light of day because those justices were not sure at that point that they could. And you wonder, you know, so many important issues about what our government was up to were buried in that right there.
I wonder, though, how much that is going to change. I mean, I think part of what's happened, you know, in the last few years, and certainly with a change in administrations, is that the perception of the threat has shifted. The threat immediately after 2001 was that we were going to be attacked in time. Nothing has happened, and we could have a whole other show as to why that may be. But ultimately, I think what is happening is, you know, there's a shift in understanding of what the problem is. And I wonder, you know, going back to your point about having a strong judiciary that is really going to stand up to the executive, you know, if the environment is different, if the perception of the threat has changed, is it possible then that the decisions by the judges will also change? Or do you think this is mostly about the amount of pressure that the executive can exert?
Boy, I think that's a hard question. I think that one of the most important factors is who appoints the judges. And then I do think that overall atmosphere does matter. There have been some important cases that have been won. There's a Judge Moreno in, I believe he's in Manhattan in a federal court there, and he's ruled twice on habeas corpus. However, he hasn't pushed forward his suit. So once again, he ruled bravely, but he hasn't done anything with it. So I don't know. I think judges are very important, but who appoints them and makes a big difference as well.
503-231-8187. It's a call-in edition of We the People. We have a caller, Jeff from Portland. Jeff, go ahead.
Hello, Alejandro.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for taking my call. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Jeff.
I was wondering if you could connect. This is going a bit astray, but not too far, because Teresa Mitchell this morning was speaking of these facilities that are being built around the country that are apparently prepared to take dissenters of all kinds at the times, or FEMA-operated when there's a big hoo-ha emergency and so forth. And speaking of civil liberties and state secrets, it seems to be it's some curious state secret that the mainstream media is not even talking about. Can you limb that out a little more for me? I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeff. I think what Jeff is getting at is perhaps that the media is, in a sense, discouraged from doing its work because, you know, the last 8 years, the trend in the last 8 years has been you asked the wrong question and we're going to shut the door on you. To what extent, Joanne, do you think that is having an impact in really understanding? In other words, has the state secrets privilege been broadened by our own sort of complacency in not pushing back when that door has been shut?
Well, I think, you know, there's so many things, in my own opinion, I think in the general public, that you can lay at the doorstep of the general media, the mainstream media, for not pursuing and not being that, you know, that watchdog role to make sure these things go through. But, you know, in the end, I think it's a question in many cases of how much, you know, if in the case of state secrets, which makes it particularly ominous, is where you have, you know, one part of our government, one part of our three branches, having total control essentially and shutting down a second part. And then through the politicalization of the rest of it, that you just simply have a brick wall where the information cannot get through. And this might not have been such a concern 10, 15, 20 years ago, where the enemy was beyond our borders and laws that we had in place perhaps protected us from these kinds of actions, or they weren't applied to our own citizenship. That's all changing now. Mm-hmm. From 2001 on, like you were saying, what we're talking about now is a new identity of the enemy, and the enemy is among us, essentially. And so now all these actions are being used against citizens. They're being used in various ways that we wouldn't have thought of in the past. And so now we have state secret coming in. I mean, my view is that it's shutting down openness, transparency, and it's used to protect, you know, what we've seen, you know, the surveillance of folks, the wiretapping, all of this preceding 2006, 2007, when they came out and tried to change the law. I mean, this is 2004, dating back to 2001, if not before.
Well, and another really important case that's been covered up or been kept covered up by the state secrets privilege being asserted is the one about Jeppesen Air. It's a subsidiary of Boeing. It operates out of California, and it's a trip planning agency, and it did the trip planning for the rendition flights, and that's by statements of people who were employed there, who were able to quote directly from meetings where they were told that this was true. And then further investigation, Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF.org, is the one pushing forward that lawsuit. And they have been very aggressively putting it forward and did not want this one to be able to go down with all of the other telecom lawsuits. And what they're and I believe the ACLU is part of this, it's about different individuals who were renditioned and put into prison and tortured by our government, and that trip planning was Jeppesen Airplane, and they're doing a civil suit against it. So much of this information about Jeppesen is online for anyone to see. I've read the documents. So where is the state secret? Just like in the AT&T case where they have the hub there, and Mark Klein revealed it, showing that the National Security Agency has a room inside AT&T's hub. All of that, including diagrams, some of it redacted, but most of it readable, is already out there in the public domain. So where's the state secret? And my feeling has been that really, the secret is to be kept from the American public. Mm-hmm. It's not to be kept from the actual real enemies of our state.
And problematically, perhaps, is that the secret is now being used to protect private parties, not just the government. But we'll come back to this conversation. After we take a short break, you're listening to We the People. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. Call 503-231-8187. We want to hear from you. Now to continue our discussion on state secrets privilege, part two of Tom Nelson interview. Thank you.
Now, this latest move by the federal government, rather than calling for an emergency injunction, they put forward a threat, basically. You said that they basically threatened that they would come and seize the document?
That's what they said. They said, we will withdraw this document if you continue down this road. And that really, for the lawyers, that is such a obvious threat to breach the separation of powers doctrine, that the executive can march into a judge's chambers and say, give me that document, I'm taking it home with me. That I hadn't heard anything like that before.
And this is under the Obama administration. This is a solution coming out of the current Justice Department.
And we tried to stick that statement with the Obama administration, because the people have a right to know what their present president is doing. We know George Bush did a lot of things, but if that threat was contained in a filing that was filed with the court, I mean, it wasn't the kind of passing remark that a lawyer will say to another lawyer in the hallway. And it was obviously vetted, at least through the trial attorney staff, and probably at a higher level, and maybe up into the political folks in the administration. So what we're seeing now is really a cause for concern when it comes to the new Obama administration.
So at this stage, what are you expecting is the next step?
Well, I think the next step is that Judge Walker and the Department of Justice will come to some kind of accommodation, and then the judge will put out some kind of order. I would expect that order will allow us to proceed further, to take steps toward obtaining the document, filing our motion for summary judgment, establishing we were illegally wiretapped under the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and ultimately, at the end of the day, creating a precedent that prohibits that and also awards damages, including costs and attorney's fees, which are staggering at this point. We have seven lawyers working on the case, all on the come basis, took it on the risk that they thought they had a good claim. The other alternative is if we don't run down the judicial avenue, is something I think the government, I'll tell them now, that they ought to consider, is just rolling over and dying, saying, yes, we're not going to admit or deny anything, and we agree that we didn't do anything wrong, but here's your money, go away, we don't want to hear from you again. That would, of course, be a major victory as well.
Either one would end up with the government basically admitting that they
That's right.
engaged in this. Now, I've heard that in prisons of U.S. prisoners, there has been standard recording of prisoner and attorney conversations, and that there's now evidence that those are regularly being made available to prosecution as well as others, that those tapes are not kept secret or they're not protected. So this is a pretty important and maybe a broader issue than just what this use of the state secrets privilege is intending to cover up. Have you heard of any other evidence of that kind of thing?
Well, one hears of it relatively constantly. I don't do a lot of that work, but I think the individuals who first went to Guantanamo knew for a fact certain. As a matter of fact, I think they were required to sign something that they acknowledged that their communications would be overheard. I've also talked to a number of individuals in prison in around the United States who were involved in national security kinds of matters, and the consistent feeling was we can't say anything too open, too widely. We expect that if the Bush rationale is going to be followed, it will be routine to listen in on attorney-client communications. We can defeat those eavesdropping attempts, I think, by taking the steps I've said, leaving your cell phone behind, going out in the street. You can't do that in a prison.
Yeah, certainly you can't do that right. when your client is locked up. When the government uses the state secrets privilege to cover up what's illegal activity or unconstitutional activity, activity they wouldn't want brought to the light of day, doesn't that reduce the credibility of the national security argument in general and make all of us wonder when is there a real national security interest involved?
Well, you go back to the Reynolds case that I cited. Now, I look at these assertions of national security with the utmost of skepticism. I don't believe what my government tells me because my government's been caught lying time and time and time and time again. You go back to cases like the Pentagon Papers. An enormous embarrassment for the administration, but certainly not any direct national security interest involved. Ships weren't sunk as a result of the disclosure of that. It was an embarrassment for the administration, and you know the problem is that when we get a timid judge, and fortunately our judges out here on the West Coast are not terribly timid, when you get a timid judge, it means you have a litigant who doesn't really have a chance to get to first base. The state secrets privilege has been treated by the judiciary generally as being a death knell and being a death order to the litigation when the privilege is raised. Courts have been reluctant in the past, prior to people like Judge Walker, going into the question, well, is this really a state secret? Rather, there's a tendency, unfortunate in my opinion, to defer to the executive assertion and not look further, dismiss the case, everybody goes home. There's legislation pending, I understand, and I don't know what happened to it, but that would require the judiciary to investigate every assertion of state secrets and to determine whether it is a bona fide assertion. That investigation obviously would be what we say ex parte. It would be by the judge without the complainants raising it.
So there are two significant victories that could come out of your case. One is that there would be an injunction to stop the spying on attorney-client privilege in your particular case, and therefore setting that precedent, making it clear that this is not acceptable and that there will be repercussions if that's taken on by the government. The other is really that the State Secrets Act itself has to be held to a higher standard than it has been in the last 8 years. It held up, I think, over 40 lawsuits against telecom companies for their warrantless wiretapping of Americans. It held up other lawsuits that we mentioned earlier. Hopefully this would, at least for a period of time, make the administration, whoever's in power, use that privilege more carefully.
Yeah, the key to what you just said there is warrantless. Our objection wasn't that our conversations were listened to, even though as an ethical matter, if I think they are, I still can't keep talking. I got to stop and take other actions. The problem with the case with the Al Haramain case is there is no warrant, even though there was a very specific federal statute in place creating a special secret court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to look at warrants requesting surveillance, wiretapping, those types of things. The Bush administration threw that aside, threw that in the dustbin, and went straight forward and did it, notwithstanding that statute. So, if you believe that there are some cases that do indeed have valid national security implications, our statement would be, for God's sake, get a warrant. In that case, no problem. I mean, that's how the system works. Anytime somebody wants to go in somebody's house looking for contraband, they get a warrant. What do they need for a warrant? Probable cause. The problem with the Bush administration is they set up this massive data mining that basically sucked in all conversations from everybody everywhere, including emails, including innocent conversations. People have nothing to do with it. Wasn't focused. It wasn't focused upon, quote, bad guys. It took in everything, and then they ran it through a bunch of filters. That's why I'm saying to the attorneys out there that you better be aware that if you're talking about a timber case, what you say on your phone or what you say in an email is going to be monitored. End of story. Now, the question is, what happens to those data after that? Who knows? But you know, this could really set us back to the 19th century, if you think about it, if lawyers become reluctant, as I am, to use modern communications as a means of talking to and dealing with their clients.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about the chilling effect on attorneys in general, handling important cases like that.
Well, number one, when you represent the kinds of people that are involved in these national security issues, it's pretty clear that the corporate world probably won't want to be hiring you anymore. I used to do a lot of corporate work. I do very little anymore because of my client list. Number two, I think since I realized that, I've taken the position that I'm not going to be bullied. I'm not going to be scared off by somebody coming in my office or perhaps going in my home or rifling through my papers or going through my email. That's not going to stop me. I think it's the cost of doing business. I think the biggest concern is people actually become reluctant to handle these kinds of cases because they think, well, the big bad government's going to get me, or I might be guilty by association, or they're going to hurt me somehow. You just can't let them do that to you. If people respond to that kind of intimidation, frankly, all is lost. You know, the biggest job, the most important job of a lawyer is to represent an unpopular client, because our system will not work unless somebody stands up and says, yes, I will represent this person, whether it's a rape case, whether it's national security, whatever it is. The lawyer's obligation is to undertake cases, even unpopular ones, that will hurt his own standing in the community. If we don't, if we worry about the government coming stealing into offices, you know, engaging in its various bag of tricks, if we allow that to deter us, our system is done. We can't allow that to happen.
Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you, Tom Nelson, attorney here in Portland, civil rights attorney and attorney on the Al Haramain case. Anything else?
No, I do hope that people will keep this case in mind as it goes forward, because there are some very critical constitutional guarantees at stake, and you know the attention span of the public generally tends to be fairly short. We hope that this case will end up with something that will have a long-lasting effect.
That was part two of an interview with Portland attorney Tom Nelson, conducted by Linda Olson Osterlund. Linda, thank you for that. That was, a very interesting interview. But I want to take a step back and talk a bit about why is it, I think it's a more fundamental question, and that is, why is it that we are continuing to see the Obama administration take a position that is very similar to that of the Bush administration? What insight do we have about why they're taking this position?
Well, one thing that I've thought about is that FISA Amendment Act of 2008, which was so widely voted for on both sides of the both Democrats and Republicans, though I want to say thank you, not our own Oregon legislative representatives, is that I think there was some agreement to cover up what the government was really doing, that it is an embarrassment and maybe that it is actually harmful for the nation to be revealed, to be spying on all of its citizens, which is really, if any of these cases were able to go forward, it would have revealed to the American public that virtually all of their email locations that they're going to are taken by the government. Whether they're ever looked at by the government, whether they're used in a filtering process, we don't know. But I think that there was an agreement, because they're all insiders, they're all part of the machine, that we shouldn't let this go forward and we'll just try to put up some protections. Also, some degree of still that fear. Maybe we really do need to spy on everyone.
Because it opens up. I mean, it's a protectionist, I think, stance at this point, and it's the safe route. That's, you know, erring on the side of protecting
the state secrets or the actions of the government. And the can of worms that it would open up, in, you know, if we were to expect the presidency to operate on principle and, you know, say, no, this isn't right, and we're not going to allow this to continue. We're going to let this case go forward, and the can of worms that would open. So, you know, there are people who will argue that side of it, that as far as what this could mean for the presidency and for the Justice Department is A, perhaps not known clearly altogether on what it really means, and B, you know, at this point, why rush into something that could, you know, tie our hands?
Well, the other thing I think that's pretty interesting about this would be if they are able to keep all of these kinds of things secret. I thought, you know, who's to say that a Democratic president doesn't want to hold to himself the same powers that a Republican president
exactly.
wanted to have, or that the Democratic Party wasn't urging him to maintain these powers. You know, those Republicans had them. You maintain them. You'll use them better. That's sort of like if it's the right guy in, it doesn't matter if it's an abuse of power. I think to some degree there's some of that.
And I think others would argue, not to necessarily take this position, but I think others would argue that the Obama administration hasn't had enough time to formulate its position, so we'll take the fallback position of the previous administration and perhaps at some point reformulate its stance on this issues and other issues relating to national security. 503-231-8187 is the number to call because we want to hear from you. We have Paul on the line. Paul, go ahead. Paul, are you there? It seems we've lost. Paul, are you there? Hello?
Is your radio turned down?
Oh, it sounds like we've temporarily lost Paul, but hopefully we'll get him back online. Paul, if you're out there, call back. We apologize if we cut you off.
And once you are put on the line, on the air, please turn down your radio. So when you call 503-231-8187, and we put you on the air, please turn down your radio. But I think the other point that you know, in addition, yes, maybe they're reformulating their position. I think there's another element, which is, and you alluded to this, which is that agencies that were involved in some of these illegal activities, whether the FBI or the CIA, and particularly I think the CIA with some of the extraordinary conditions, the secret prisons abroad and so forth, I think there must be some concern, some degree of pressure that they're exerting on the administration to not investigate or look too deeply. I mean, Obama has said, I want to look forward. I don't want to spend too much time looking backward.
And there's quite a bit of pressure to, like, bring Bush and Cheney and bring Rumsfeld to be investigated. So I think you're right. They're certainly holding off on moving forward with any of that. Do we have our caller back online? I believe it's Paul.
Yes, Paul? I'm here.
Hi, Paul. Go ahead. So go forward.
There's a few things that come to mind, and like one, number one is where do we go from here? It seems to me that we need to, for starters, send Obama emails. I mean, I'm beginning to lose faith in how much good that'll do, but I'm still enough of a Pollyanna to do it. That, I mean, he came from a constitutional law background, and I think we ought to ask him, what the heck over. But the other thing is that work for people that are going to ensure that good judges are appointed. I've been disappointed for many years that the Congress has let Republicans in Congress or forestall good judges being appointed, or they haven't stopped bad judges. And I think that we need to, and maybe after I finish, Alejandro can go bring us up to speed on the appointment process and how we get the people into the system. I think they start at the state level before they get to be considered for federal.
Paul, I think you're talking about something really important, that selection of judges.
Absolutely, and Alejandro can talk more about that, but when you're talking about where we go from here, I think, one of the things that has been generated out of the Senate is Patrick Leahy's and Arlen Specter's, the State Secret Protection Act, which we mentioned earlier on this, and what that does is really firm up, again, the powers of Congress and the powers of the judiciary to review the claims by the federal government that something is a state secret. It provides a structured procedure. It requires requires. It actually requires judges to look at the evidence that the government claims is privileged, and that's rather than currently where they can simply rely on government affidavits. So it's a matter of trust in that sense, but as it is now, and then this would move it actually into reviewing the evidence. And these are really key, important steps that have to be taken, and it's one step to push back. And I think if we continue pushing back with this kind of legislation, with the judges, as you said, and staying on top of what's happening, I think then there can be some pressure brought.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that Paul is trying to make as well, which is, you know, where do we go from here? What do we do next? And I think one of the key points that we alluded to earlier as well is to understand, A, what the Obama administration thinks of the state secrets privilege. Because one of the things that this act does is basically sets up a pretty high standard for when the court must dismiss these cases. And the government must show that there is no other alternative for presenting the classified evidence in a way that protects the national security. And so it really is crafting, I think, what is a pathway for recourse for plaintiffs when otherwise that recourse doesn't exist.
Right.
And I think in order for us to understand better the Obama administration's position, we need to understand what their position is with respect to this bill.
Right, right. And, you know, it doesn't look good at this point considering their responses. I mean, they are pushing forward. They're even talking about, as you mentioned earlier in your interview with Tom, that the discussion of even forcibly walking in and retrieving these documents. I mean, it's come to that kind of a push and shove. But it's a step in the right direction, and, you know, it still protects generous protections for national security. So, you know, and you raised the question earlier regarding 60 days into the administration, what are we expecting to see?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a couple of calls. I want to thank Paul for his input. Jack, I believe, is online.
Yeah, that's right, and thanks for doing this show. To be honest with you, I don't expect anything from this administration on this issue. I just think that this whole issue of state security and what's going to be decided at the highest levels of the security networks, you know, they're going to do what their handlers tell them to do, and the administration that was quote unquote elected isn't the ones making the decisions there. I'm sorry to say that, but I feel that's the way it is, and I just don't think there's, you know, it's, I don't think anything is going to change in the way that those people have chosen to go around the FISA court, and if you look at that very carefully, I think it's clear that the reason they chose to go around the FISA court is because they don't want anything turned up at all on their own black ops to go before a judge. And I think that's what all the secrecy is about. And if they're spying on American citizens, I would assume that it's just to see if anybody out here is figuring out what they're doing in terms of their black ops. There are so many black ops going on, and they're not only going on overseas, they're going on everywhere, here too. And you know, you got secrecy within secrecy, layers and layers, and I don't know if there's any way to get enough transparency on any of it so that they can really be busted. At the end of the day, I just say investigate, indict, prosecute, and execute, because the people that are doing this stuff, they're traitors.
Thanks for that point of view. You know, you feel really strongly about it, and I think I understand your point of view that maybe we'll never be able to trust this. I think that's one of the reasons that independent media is so important. I think that the chance to expose what they try to keep secret, so that even if all three houses of the government want to keep it secret, if there's independent media and there are people who want to whistleblow, there's always a chance to reveal what's happening behind the scenes, which I think is one of the reasons I love KBOO. I wanted to let people know that if they want to hear this show later and hear the interview with Tom Nelson, that they can just go to kboo.fm. We will have it logged up within an hour or so after the show. Just look for We the People. I believe we have another caller on the line. Is that right, Alejandro?
Yeah, I believe David is on the line.
Yeah.
Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey there. Yeah, I just wanted to add one more comment. I mean, and I don't know, it's just sort of an element that comes up to me a lot that I don't think is covered in these issues, which is I'm against our government spying on us in any form almost ever. But, you know, there's always this idea that if there's something really dangerous or important, then it's okay for us to get rid of our constitutional laws, or it's okay for them to spy on us. And I think this whole terrorism thing is always like, well, there it is. This is this big problem. But I think what even says that this is such a dangerous thing? I mean, in the entire history of the United States, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people have been killed by terrorists, mostly all in the towers. You know, it's like worrying about lightning strike. And I think an earlier stage of this whole problem is that just saying just because it's about catching terrorists isn't actually such a dangerous thing for us as people in this country. That's all I wanted to say, and I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that issue as well.
I certainly appreciate your perspective, David. I think that one of the issues that this administration and the American people will have to deal with is what is the right balance? How do we not compromise our constitutional rights, our civil liberties, while at the same time understanding what the nature of the threat is? And I think what we're seeing is, as we've moved away from 2001, from 9/11 and that incident, that we have a clear vision, a clear understanding of what the state of the world is and where the real conflicts and the real threats of terrorism exist. So I appreciate that perspective. We've come to the end of the show, but I want to thank our contributors, particularly Linda Olson-Esterlund for producing such a great interview with Tom Nelson, as she's indicated that will be available online very shortly. I also want to thank Patrick Kilpatrick, who produced the first piece on the first segment of our show. And finally, Joanne Zoll, Street Roots editor and contributor to We the People. I'm your host, Alejandro Queral, and we will be back the last Thursday of the month. Join us for another edition. We will be addressing national security and the economy. So join us last Thursday of the month at 6 p.m.